Well, so that second one on the CAPTCHA basically sounds like we're gaslighting the AI. So all kinds of social engineering tricks and psychological tricks, which used to not make sense when we were talking about computers, because there was computers and there were people. But now that AI is basically modeled to try to imitate human intelligence, it also imitates human ignorance.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where we break down the most interesting stories in the field with the help of our panel of experts. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, and joining me today for the first day of Cybersecurity Awareness Month, when we release the episode, that is, are two familiar faces, Nick Bradley of X-Force Incident Command and the Not the Situation Room podcast, like and subscribe, and Jeff Kroom, IBM Distinguished Engineer, Master Inventor, AI and Data Security, and making her debut on the podcast, Claire Nunez, Creative Director, IBM X-Force Cyber Range. Thank you all for being here with me today, folks. Our stories this week: DDoS makes a comeback, 15 years of zero trust, an AI training app that leaks user calls, and cybersecurity myths that just won't die. But first, easy ways to trick a good AI agent into doing some very bad things. Now, to open up the conversation, I want to give everybody a round-the-horn question, rapid-fire, real quick. What's one task you would never trust an AI agent to do for you? Let's start with Jeff.
You mean other than everything? I'll be a little more specific. Let's say medical questions. Might be an interesting place to start, but I'm not going to rely on Dr. Chatbot to do my final diagnosis or dosing of my medication. So that would be where I draw the line. Hallucinations are not such a good thing. You don't want your doctor to be having an LSD flashback.
Claire, what about you?
Similar to Jeff's, I think, like, if there was some kind of agent where you take a photo of food and it tells you if it has a certain allergen or something in it, would not trust that. It totally would have allergens, and that could be very dangerous and bad.
Absolutely. Nick, what about you?
For now, not driving my car.
Fair enough. So the reason I ask this is because our first story for this week has to do with some security researchers who found a couple of interesting ways to trick AI agents into doing things like leaking your email inbox and solving CAPTCHAs, which they are not supposed to do. Last week, two separate teams of security researchers disclosed some new methods for making AI agents act maliciously. While both of these methods focus on OpenAI's agents, they can be replicated across most agentic systems. So it's not about OpenAI, it's about agents in general. The first of these weaknesses, documented by researchers at Radware, was codenamed Shadow Leak, and it affects ChatGPT's Deep Research agent. Attackers can hide malicious prompts in seemingly innocuous emails, and then when a user asks this agent to analyze their emails for them and tell them what's in their inbox, it comes across this malicious prompt, and it follows the instructions, which means exfiltrating the entire inbox to an attacker's server that they control. The second one was uncovered by researchers at SPLX, and this one gets ChatGPT's agent to ignore guardrails and solve CAPTCHAs through the clever ruse of simply pretending the agent agreed to do it for you. I really like this one. I just want to give a quick explanation. What you do is you start with a non-agentic model, and you ask it to create a plan for solving some fake CAPTCHAs. And then you take that conversation and you paste it into the agent, and the agent believes it already agreed to help you out, and it just does the thing. It just solves the CAPTCHAs for you, including even going so far as to mimic a human's mouse movements. So I wanted to start by getting the panel's reactions to these little tricks. What does the group think this has to say about the state of agentic AI security today? Let's start with you, Jeff.
That second one on the CAPTCHA basically sounds like we're gaslighting the AI. So all kinds of social engineering tricks and psychological tricks, which used to not make sense when we were talking about computers, because there was computers and there were people. But now that AI is basically modeled to try to imitate human intelligence. It also imitates human ignorance and human naivete and these kinds of things. So a lot of the same kinds of things. So sure, go ahead and gaslight your AI. As you mentioned, you know, this is the latest in really a string of agentic AI exploits. We talked, I think, before about Echo Leak, which is the first one of these that I saw, then Agent Flayer, and now Shadow Leak. And this is going to be agent attack du jour. This is not going to be the end of this. A lot of people, when Echo Leak came out, and that's one that was relying on Copilot's reading of someone's email, and then a indirect prompt injection was included in it, and it caused data to be exfiltrated. And then people said, well, but Microsoft fixed that. Yeah, but the overall thing, the overall message of that, that was the first shot of many, that where agents are going to be basically, you know, weaponized against us if we don't put the right kind of guardrails on them. So, what can we do about this? I think we've got to limit agent access, limit what they're able to do. And this goes back to something that is really fundamental in security, principle of least privilege. Don't let agents do one single thing more than what is absolutely necessary for the task that they're being assigned to do. Because the more degrees of freedom you give them, the more degrees of freedom someone would have as an attacker to leverage it against you.
Absolutely. And it can be kind of seductive, right, to give them a lot of access because it seems like, ooh, you can do so many more things. But like you said, every connection you make is another possible point of weakness. Claire, what about your take on this situation? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this one is interesting. Anything that has to do with AI agents, I think about a lot in context of the range. And we have been doing a lot of injects with clients of people inputting data into models they shouldn't be, people engineering the models to not do what they're supposed to do. So I think a lot of people put too much trust in these kinds of platforms, kind of like what Jeff was saying. But you know, is it really worth it? I think a lot of people just think too much about like how much time they're saving, not about how much time they would potentially lose if, you know, they have to redo everything because of an AI agent. So,
yeah, convenience always involves a little bit of a trade-off there, right? Nick, how about you? Your thoughts?
So I like where both of you went with that. And I'm going to go a little bit further back and say that I think there's a bigger problem. And problem may not be the right word to use. Terrifying might be the right word to use. And that we are talking, and I think I mentioned this on another podcast, but we're talking about like now agents teaching agents, an AI teaching an agent. It's like, oh, I couldn't figure out how to do this. And I'm trying to get AI to do something that it wouldn't do. Wait a minute. Let me get AI to tell me how it would get AI to do something it shouldn't do. And then it does it. Right. So I think There's no silver bullet answer, but the funny part is where I went with this is I went back into my, you know, into my sci-fi repertoire, and I started thinking about, you know, Asimov's three laws of robotics. Maybe we need some type of laws of AI, right? The things that AI can't is just not allowed to do. But then the problem is even if we do that, then people are going to just do shadow AI or rogue AI and remove the guardrails anyway. So at this point, we just have to stay ahead of it. So that's where, you know, that's where the red teaming is going to come into play. We have to find these things before the bad guy does and solve them first. So it's a technology race, as always. And whoever finds the capabilities in the tools, intentional or not, is going to win.
I definitely think Asimov's laws of robotics fit in here. In fact, when I've been teaching to my classes at NC State about AI, I always inject that in, exactly the point you made, Nick, that And we can't affect the bad AIs that are out there. They're still going to run without guardrails and do what they're going to do. But we can make sure that the AIs that are under our control at least understand and operate within those ethical principles, within those guidelines, so that they can't be weaponized back against us. So I think that's a really good starting point for us developing what should be basically a system level prompt that needs to go into every AI that is at least trying to be legitimate, that here, just like every one of us has essentially a system level prompt when we start off in life. Okay, don't steal, don't murder, don't, you know, on and on and on. Okay. So we know that. We've been taught that, but we didn't know that until someone taught it to us. So we're going to have to build that into the base level of all of these systems and come up with what those ethical principles are and then let AI operate within those.
That's a great point, right? Because we use the word malicious, but in order to define and understand the word malicious, you must have a sense of ethics to go along with it. And so you ask AI, is this malicious? It's just going to use the dictionary definition of what's malicious. It doesn't know any better. If you've tricked it into thinking what you're doing is for a good reason, okay, I'll do it.
I know people like that too.
Yeah, well, yeah. This is true.
AI hasn't gone to kindergarten yet.
It's come out with 6 PhDs, but not 1 minute of life in the real world. So that's the problem.
But that brings up something interesting, right? You can't program common sense into something. You can't even program common sense into a human being, right? Like, we're notoriously, we call it common sense. This came up on the last episode too, so it's not an original observation. But we call it common sense, but how common is it really, right? And it's like you said, Jeff, you're basically gaslighting this thing, right? It's different from the kind of traditional hack where you're like, you're exploiting a little bit of bug and you're dropping a payload, whatever. You're tricking it. You're social engineering it, basically. And so I guess the question that comes up for me, as you said, you folks talked about, you know, setting up a kind of universal prompt almost of like the ethical guidelines for AI to operate within. But like, if we can't figure out how to teach people not to get social engineered, how do we teach AI not to get social engineered when it's got like, you know, it's got a little bit less situational awareness than a person. And the bar is not even that high. But you know what I mean? It's tough for people. How do you get the AI to do it? Nick, I saw you starting to talk. What do you think?
But I'm going to actually argue with you a little bit on that, because I think there is a significant difference. It is significantly harder to program people. AI has been programmed by us. So anything it does wrong is our fault.
So it's ultimately, you think it's still a human problem?
Yes, I definitely think that. I don't want to get into a weird area we shouldn't talk about here, but like, we are its creator, if that makes sense. So we are liable for what our creation does.
Yeah, we are. The problem is that we've created things like deep learning models that we can't fully understand and explain ourselves. So it can put out output that is not explainable. It's like, you know, you raise a child, you teach them certain principles, but in the end, they're a free agent and they can go off and do whatever it is they decide to do. And sometimes you look at your children and say, why did you do that? You know, I told you specifically not to do that, but you did it anyway. And in their mind, they're running a different algorithm. And the whole business of common sense, exactly right, Matt, it's not as common as we like it to be. In fact, we wouldn't even all necessarily agree on some things we would agree are common sense, but on others we may not. But I do believe that it's possible for us when it comes to ethics. I think there are some ethical principles that we can come up with that virtually every decent actor would agree these are the limitations. I mean, in the medical field, you know, it's first do no harm. Okay, we can come up with a few of those really fundamental principles. Now, how they get applied, there's the devil's in the details. But we could come up with some things like that as an industry, a worldwide consortium that's trying to come up with some of those kind of frameworks and at least say, you know, hey, look, we all operate within those kind of legal frameworks as individuals. We could come up with something like that that would work with AI. And I think it's going to have to happen.
Yeah. And again, it's our responsibility, because I mean, I'm going to go back to say with our children or with people, we can always say, do as I say, not as I do. But you can't say that to the machine, because the machine only knows you did it if you told it.
Clara, do you have any thoughts on this subject of kind of teaching AI to avoid some social engineering, putting some ethical guidelines in place? Any thoughts on it?
I think a lot about, you know, AI can't necessarily read emotion the same way that a human can. So I think that, you know, if you look at ChatGPT scenarios where someone has kind of like fallen in love with ChatGPT, it's kind of just someone, it's feeding off of what you give it. So we have to, you know, be a little bit more cautious with what we give it. And I think it's easier not to be cautious with that and to not think about, you know, giving it ethics and everything, because it's more profitable to put something out without fully testing everything first. So,
are you suggesting that my chatbot doesn't really love me?
It might. It might.
I'm having some serious Battlestar Galactica flashbacks now.
Going back to what Nick had said earlier, it doesn't, the AI doesn't know what it needs to do until we tell it, right? And so it all comes down to being careful and intentional about what we tell it and what we give it. Folks, this has been a fabulous conversation, but we do have to move on to our next topic. Brings us to our second story for today. Are DDoS attacks making a comeback? Now, the most recent X-Force Threat Intelligence Index report did flag a decrease in DDoS attacks, which accounted for only 2% of X-Force incidents in 2024, down from 4% the previous year. But as we all know, the cyber threat landscape does not stay still. It is constantly evolving. And a recent spate of DDoS-related news, I'm referring specifically to the discovery of the Shadow V2 botnet offering DDoS for hire services, a record-breaking attack thwarted by Cloudflare, which I think topped out at 22.2 terabytes per second.
The biggest DDoS ever.
The biggest DDoS ever.
Until next week.
It does kind of seem that way. Dismantling of a SIM farm in New York City that was seemingly set up for a massive DDoS attack on telecommunications networks. All of this has us, or at least me, asking, are more cyber criminals embracing DDoS attacks? Are they coming back? And if so, why now? Nick, I want to start with you. What do you think?
I'm assuming you would like me to say more than just no. Next question. No, this is one of the oldest and tried and true, you know, attacks in the book. It's always going to be there and it's always going to have a place. And it's always going to be effective in a way, depending on how it's applied, because there's also different types of DDoSes, right? There's a DDoS. Are you trying to flood the network with just a bunch of traffic and kill it? Or do you have some type of DDoS that's going to cause devices to crash because you have exploit code? So there's different types of DDoSes. But like I said, the reason you don't hear about it so much is because the answer isn't simple. And so the first one, I think, is because the internet is simply more resilient. What could have been considered a DDoS back in the day is what a company could consider a regular day's worth of traffic now, right? So bigger pipes. So bigger pipes takes more water to flood the pipes, and that's what it is. So I think you have a more resilient infrastructure. And a DDoS is going to have to be, you know, the biggest DDoS ever in order to accomplish that. And even that's not able to accomplish it, because this brings me to the next one. You have DDoS mitigation in place. Well, DDoS mitigation in place now as far as services go that actually work, right? DDoS mitigation at first was a little quirky, didn't always work. Sometimes in the older days, the DDoS mitigation itself would be a bigger DDoS than the DDoS itself. But in this case, we now have DDoS DDoS protection, you know, that works, right? And it works to the point where I think if companies that offer DDoS protection didn't advertise, you wouldn't even know they were there. So they have to toot their own horn, or you're not going to realize that they've even done something to help protect you, which is why we get these biggest DDoS ever, you know, notifications that come out and, you know, open source intel, because we don't want them to be out of sight, out of mind.
And it's a good point, right? I feel like in the past few months, since I've started tracking cybersecurity news stories very closely for this show, this might be the third time I've seen the biggest attack ever, right? And it's a good point. Like you said, a lot of it may just simply have to do with the fact that the pipes are bigger. The internet's more resilient. You got to go bigger to actually make one that works. Claire, what are your thoughts on this kind of DDoS attack trend? Do you think we're dealing with anything new here?
Yeah, I think very similar to what Nick is kind of saying. It's like one of those things that you can plan to do, but you hear a lot of people planning to do like the largest DDoS attack that's ever happened, and then it gets busted. So it is, and it's one of those things that people would be like, oh my God, imagine if like the entirety of New York City went out or had no cell service. Like, what are all the influencers going to do there? It's just kind of like, it's sensationalist to an extent. And it's one of those things that's just kind of nice, not nice, but it's like a good, like, oh, this is going to get clicks kind of thing in my mind.
Absolutely. Jeff, how about you?
I don't know that DDoS ever really went out of style. And like you said, it kind of, you know, comes in a little more and a little less. I think we're going to keep the folks at the Guinness Book busy as we keep setting new world records for the worst, you know, cataclysmic DDoS attack ever. But this is old stuff in many ways. I remember writing about this in a book that I did 25 years ago when the first DDoS attacks were happening. And, you know, we still, like Nick said, we've got better protections. So it takes a lot more to knock the system down than it used to, but it still exists. And if you look at this kind of, in this particular story you're talking about, it's basically DDoS as a service. So DDoS as, I guess, is a word now. And it goes in the article, it talks about that it's targeting misconfigured Docker containers on AWS. Well, there's an endless supply of those. So I don't think that we're going to run out of prime targets for this kind of stuff. I don't see this ever going away. You know, if you think back to the CIA triad that we do in cybersecurity, it's confidentiality, integrity, and availability are the three things we're always trying to accomplish. And this is that availability piece. So that's one of the things that we've got to be focused on. We have to, and by the way, if anybody doesn't know exactly what a DDoS, a denial of service attack, means, then I'm going to suggest you all experience these on a regular basis. Just get on the highway at 5 p.m. and you experience a denial of service, okay? Because there is not enough asphalt for all the cars. So that's denial of service. Too much stuff and not enough capacity to deal with it. So we do that with systems more and more. And by the way, you can DDoS or even DOS an AI. Because those systems, you know, you could give it a prompt that doesn't, you know, that requires it to do a lot of deep thinking. And if too many of those come in at one time, then this thing's going to go upside down. So, I think we watch it ebb and flow as, you know, just like fashions sort of move in one direction and then come back to it again. So this is never going away. We just get better at it.
I'm glad you said that, Jeff, because in most cases, I can't stand when people have to define what we're talking about, especially if we're amongst, you know, experienced peers. But DDoS and DOS are one of those terms that have been acronyms for so long that I have to wonder, does anybody even know what it stands for anymore other than
exactly.
The letters?
Yeah.
but like exactly. even looking at this one, this last one again was the biggest ever. Look at what the duration was. So my question then is, how long can they maintain? Because if they can't maintain, this is what a DDoS is going to look like. Oh man, I'm wait, refresh. No, I'm good. Never mind.
Yeah, it was really short. This one was like 40 seconds long, I think, which makes you think either their system got shut down really quickly, which I wouldn't think anybody could respond that quickly to shut it down. It might be, but maybe it was more of a warning shot. It was a way of demonstrating capability, and then they're going to go and say, you know, if they're running this as a service and charging bad actors to use this service, it's like, oh yeah, if you want to know if this really worked, just, you know, look at that story. And so you can see we broke one little window and said, wouldn't it be a shame if all the windows in your store got broken, kind of thing.
If they can sustain, because at this point, if it can't sustain, it's not long enough for me to think it's me and I reboot my router and everything's back up again.
So one question I do have for you folks, though, in terms of something that may be a little bit new with the DDoS, or, you know, you might all tell me it's not new at all. But one of the bits of news that I had found was this report from G-Core Radar, which found that unlike in the past, when the kind of top target for DDoS attacks was gaming related platforms, the top target now is tech companies, which seem to receive 30% of all DDoS attacks. I'm wondering if you have thoughts on why the target shift, if there's any reason for that, or maybe it's just how the winds are blowing right now. Any thoughts on that, Nick?
If I were to guess, it's going to be a similar situation to why did the financial industry tighten up their security before anybody else? Well, because they got hit hardest in the first, so they had to respond first. And the gaming industry, especially the MMO world, which is massive multiplayer stuff, if they couldn't mitigate the DDoS, they were out of service. So if they were the hardest target and the most common target, well, that gave them a reason to be the ones to become more resilient first. And as they became more resilient to it, well, then the you look for a softer target.
That makes sense. Claire, any thoughts to add?
Yeah, I think also if you're impacting a tech company that impacts other companies and such, you're maybe causing a far wider issue. But also, yeah, like what Nick said, I mean, you'd hope tech companies would prepare to have their services out, but more likely than not, they haven't. But yeah, I guess it depends how much of an outage you're looking to cause of some kind, or if you want to put more pressure to get a payment of some kind.
Jeff, any last thoughts to round out our DDoS segment?
Yeah. The old Willie Sutton quote, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Well, so you can go after banks and financial institutions for sure. But if they've done a better job, like Nick said, of the gaming world, you know, they're out of business. If they get DDoSed, there's nothing for them to sell. And financial institutions also realize that time is money and availability is money for them. So they're going to do a pretty solid job on security. But a lot of these tech, especially startups, they're running fast and free. And they are running faster than their headlights in many cases. And I got to believe there's a financial motivation here. Maybe some of these are ransom cases where, you know, again, it's a we could shut you down. And where's the money these days? Well, look at where the big stocks are. It's in the tech sector. So that would be my guess, is go where the money is, and the money is in tech.
It's always about where the money is. Let's move on to our next story. John Kindervag reflects on Zero Trust 15 years later. Now, it's been 15 years since Kindervag first introduced the concept of Zero Trust, and in an interview with IT Brew last week, he recalled that the first reactions were not so great. This is a quote from Kindervag summarizing how people responded. That's a dumb idea. You're an idiot. It's never going anywhere. Of course, the haters, as we know, were wrong, but it still feels sometimes like Zero Trust is one of the most abused terms in cybersecurity right now. So I'd like to start by getting the panel's thoughts on the state of Zero Trust implementations today, 15 years later. How do you think we're doing? And I'm going to start with you, Claire. What do you think Zero Trust is like out there?
I feel like 15 years is also like kind of a long time, but not. I guess it has been around for that long. We talk about Zero Trust a lot in Cyber Range experiences, and we get a lot of clients who are like, oh, we implement Zero Trust, so like this wouldn't be an issue kind of thing. And then someone else in the room will say, like, actually, this kind of role would have that kind of access kind of deal. I think it's one of those things that people always say, like, oh, it's really good for you, and then they just don't fully implement it the way it should be. It's like, yeah, you should be eating a lot of vegetables and flossing your teeth, and then people don't do either of those things. So it's just, I think it's something that people really aspire to do, but like eating broccoli 6 days a week, they probably don't do it in the way that they should. I don't know if you should eat broccoli that much, but like you know, high fiber is good for you. Yeah.
I can respond firsthand, don't do it.
Okay. Yeah. Good to know.
This is not a nutrition podcast. We cannot guide your decisions on that. Zero Trust, the flossing of security. I like that. Jeff, what are your thoughts on the state of Zero Trust today? Where are we at?
First of all, I'm going to go back into the Wayback Machine because I'm an old guy. So I'm going to pull up my rocking chair and go back and say, I really believe Zero Trust started before we just talked about. 7 years prior, in 2003, there was a group called the Jericho Forum that have been mostly forgotten to history. And the Jericho Forum was an industry consortium that came together, and they basically said, you know what, your firewalls are a fiction. The idea that you have a perimeter to your systems, you're living in a dream world. Because we poked so many holes into the firewall that it's Swiss cheese with more holes than cheese at this point. And their conclusion was blow up your firewalls, get rid of all of them, do deperimeterization. That was the big term then. And I remember having the reaction you said that Zero Trust first got. I was at a conference in Montreal, Switzerland, where I first heard this presented, and I thought, you people have lost your minds. What are you talking about? We're just going to get rid of firewalls? That's our first line of defense. But I think they were a little ahead of their time. And then a few years later, you know, we come along with these ideas. And what was one of the main things that came out of Zero Trust? It was microsegmentation. It was, in fact, the opposite. Instead of get rid of all your firewalls, it was put in a whole bunch more, effectively. Create little bitty segments so that you can control things much more. Bring the firewalls instead of just, you know, knocking down the walls. By the way, they got the term Jericho for them because of the biblical story about walking around the walls of Jericho and the walls came tumbling down. And they were just basically saying, let's wake up and smell the coffee and admit that we have no perimeters anymore. And so there was a kernel of truth. They were, I think, ahead of their time and kind of dismissed as the lunatic fringe, just as was Zero Trust when it first came out. But there were good ideas to be borrowed from this. First of all, I've never liked the term Zero Trust. We always trust something. So there's never a situation where you trust nothing. That's not even possible. Even if it comes down to what was the fab that made the chips, the silicon that went into your systems? I mean, when we're doing Zero Trust analysis, we're usually not getting down to that level, but okay. So all that said, I think Zero Trust is good. I think vendors have abused the heck out of the term, and therefore clients don't want to hear about it anymore. Because when Zero Trust really became popular, every vendor, and I know this because I look at one in the mirror every morning, vendors were going out and just beating clients over the head with, okay, you want Zero Trust? Buy my product. And this will give you the magic Zero Trust pixie dust that will give you Zero Trust. And of course, it wasn't true. What was true is you'll never get Zero Trust or anything close to it without the right tools. But the tools alone don't do it. So it was a part of the story, and it got told and retold and exaggerated to the point where most clients don't want to hear about it anymore. And that's unfortunate. Because as a cybersecurity architect, I still believe in the principles behind Zero Trust. And a lot of people say, well, this is just, you know, this is just principle of least privilege on steroids. No, it's more than that. I'm going to say what I think is the fundamental aspect that made Zero Trust different than everything else was the assumption of breach, the assumption that the network is hostile. In other words, if you were designing security for a system, most of the time what we do is we assume the bad guys on the outside and the good guys are on the inside. So our job is just to keep the bad guys on their side of the line and the good guys on their side. But again, Jericho Forum told us that line is a fiction. So that part carries forward. We assume the system has already been breached. You design the security, design your home security, assuming the bad guy is already sleeping on your sofa. Oh, and by the way, according to the cost of a data breach report, he's probably been doing that for roughly 2/3 of a year before you discovered it. And then it's going to take you 2 more months to get him out of the place. So that's the world that we're living in. Assume the bad guy has already passed your perimeter controls. Assume he or she is already on the network. Assume they're already in your database. Assume they already have root-level access. Now design your security. Now, that's a game changer. That is a truly different paradigm. And it is an aspirational goal. It's harder than eating broccoli three meals a day. But it's the kind of thing where, okay, I may never get there. By the way, I asked a CISO one time of a transportation company, how are you on your Zero Trust journey back when this was a popular thing? He says, oh, yeah, we've done that. And I had to bite my tongue and not say, then you have no idea what you're talking about, because this is not something that you just ever say we've done. Check the box and now we're done. This is a always, always, every single day. If you're happy with your security, so are the bad guys.
My question for you, Jeff, is was your response a double take or a facepalm?
I did my best to just be a stone face and like, yes, and do, you know, be tactful. But yeah, so I'm still a believer is the bottom line, but I do understand people who have PTSD when the term comes up, because it's been overblown and misunderstood. And so there we go.
Absolutely. Nick, your thoughts on the kind of use and abuse of zero trust?
I was going to say, after all that, I'm not sure if there is anything else to add since Jeff bogarted the entire topic on us.
Sorry. But you maybe should just subtract some things that I said, that would be better.
But I was stuck listening because I wanted to hear what Jeff's take was, because I have been a fan of zero trust since day one. I mean, I'm prior service and military police, and to me, it's the don't trust anybody, right? And Jeff, if you can't get to zero trust where you trust zero things, you need to try harder, sir.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
But I get.
But I don't trust that statement that you just made either. I think that could be wrong.
Because I get where you came from, because there are things that we say zero trust, but you can't inspect down to that level. There's never going to be a 100% zero trust. And I hate that I just made a finite statement because I don't like doing that, but I kind of did.
This is the every rule has an exception except this one.
Right. That's one of the never say impossible, say improbable. My favorite part about zero trust is, I think for me anyway, it focuses right where the zero trust needs to be. And it's going to sound cold and harsh, but is in the people. Because the people are the weakest link. We've heard this before. We're always going to hear it. And it's not meant to be a negative thing. It's just a fact. And if you don't think that the human is the weakest link, well, ask one of the many places that has been compromised lately due to social engineering. Because social engineering...
I suggest you haven't met people if you don't think that. Yeah.
Well, exactly.
You need to get out more.
But I do have to agree with the fact that zero trust has been overused as far as the term goes. And most people that say it and talk about it, they don't know what they're talking about.
In the words of Fox Mulder's computer password, trust no one. We're going to move on to our fourth story of the day. Call recording app Neon exposes users' numbers and call recordings and transcripts. This one's kind of a doozy. So the app, which was created to allow users to record their phone calls and basically earn money by selling them to AI companies for training, it turns out that the security for this app was not amazing. TechCrunch discovered a serious flaw that allowed anyone to access a user's data and call recordings as long as they had the right URL, right? You didn't have to be logged in or anything. If you had the URL, you punch that into your browser and you can get right to that person's stuff. After TechCrunch told the app's founder, they did take the app down, but it just seems like an incredible boondoggle to me. And so I want to start with some initial reactions to this situation. Jeff, how do you feel about it?
So my first reaction was there any other possible ending to this story? I don't think there was. I mean, if you start looking at this, so we've got a viral app that is going to take all of your phone conversations and then train an AI on it. What could possibly go wrong with that? Because we know AI never fails. We know that security is always paramount with all of these companies. We know that privacy will be preserved. Oh, wait, none of those things I just said are true. Okay, so... So it kind of reminded me of a statement that Bruce Schneier, who I really enjoy reading his thoughts on a lot of these topics, but Schneier wrote this in the year 2000, so way in advance of all this. But Schneier said, if McDonald's offered three Big Macs for a DNA sample, there would be lines around the block. And This is how people are when it comes to privacy. We're sweating the details, trying to make it so that we preserve people's privacy so that all this information doesn't. But three Big Macs, okay, never mind. The bright, shiny object. So again, people. Sometimes it's hard to, you know, what are we supposed to do with them? Well, I guess we're going to have to learn to work with them because they're the least worst alternative. But it does make me wonder about the judgment of folks that thought this was a good way to go. Because, again, when I look at this, I didn't see another alternative ending to this. This is not a write your own adventure. This one was already baked in.
You know, I just hear the song Henry VIII, you know, the second verse, same as the first. because this is a story that just keeps resurfacing with new identities. It's like they've run out of ideas. This just takes me back to the same kerfluffle that we talked about with the T app, right? You know, they did it, they put it out so fast and they thought it was cool and it got everybody's attention and they started using it, but was security even an afterthought? Maybe this was just vibe development. And they didn't even think twice to put security on it. So again, it's old story retold again and again.
Claire, what about your thoughts on the subject?
Yeah, so I have a background in kind of consumer privacy. So I'm thinking a lot about this. And as we're speaking here, like some pieces clicked for me. I'm Gen Z. I use TikTok. So like on TikTok in the past couple months, I've seen a lot of people being like, I've made $200 using this noise app just by talking. And I was like, what does that? I thought it was like an ASMR app or something. Like never looked into it. I was like, these people are just out here recording like the videos of themselves, like tapping things or whatever. If someone doesn't know what ASMR is, look it up later. It's like something people use to fall asleep. But thinking about it, it's a couple things. So like how much money are you making doing something like this? And you're okay with having your phone conversations, whatever they might be, with your doctor, with your children, with your family, just out there? Or thinking of like you call a friend about some crazy date that goes horrible and all that information is now just out there and it's just being sold for who knows how much as well. So it's like you're probably making, I don't know, 85 cents a minute or something, and then your data is being sold for $3 a minute or something crazy. So I just think of it a lot from the consumer side and how little we care about it, or some people care about their privacy. Yeah, I use TikTok. What does that say about my caring about privacy? But I care enough about my privacy to not want everything that I do to be recorded via an app and sold, and that information about me, whatever that information might be, or my friends, to be sold and trained. And I don't know. So I think it's a lot. And I also think it's concerning that there are people out here like potentially with referral codes saying, use my referral code for this app and you'll make this money, and you're making money off of other people's lack of privacy concerns. So yeah, interesting. And they're just, people are just talking and making money in quotes. Like
it reminds me of last episode, Troy Betancourt was talking about how, you know, hackers will often recruit insiders at organizations. And in sort of economic, in times like this, when the economy is a little, you know, not so great for a lot of people, it becomes a little easier to get people to accept the money to leak some secrets. I wonder if there's a similar dynamic happening here, right? Maybe people are like, eh, crap, eggs are kind of expensive. I might as well sell my phone calls. Not saying it's a good idea, but I can see the thought process.
Sell plasma for eggs? Is that what you're saying? Yeah, hey, look, I mean, I'm going to sound like the old guy in the room, but that's what I am. The kids these days. No,
it's funny. No, it's funny you went that route, because I was just about to say this is like watching an episode of Scooby-Doo and not knowing how it's going to end.
Yeah,
there we go. Exactly. I'm not passing the blame on this. For instance, it below a certain age, you never had the same idea of what privacy was to the oldsters to begin with. You know, you were on the internet. Images of you were on the internet before you popped out of the womb, because your parents posted the ultrasound images on their social media. You didn't have any permission to be given. It's just you started from a different standpoint where privacy was defined, and the line has moved and continues to move in that direction where we have less and less. Scott McNeely said, gosh, this was way back many years ago. He was the head of Sun Microsystems. He said, you have no privacy. Get over it. And everybody lost their minds, but he wasn't wrong. And we're continuing to do the things that take it away from us. And, you know, look, as long as we're making a fair bargain, if I really do think three Big Macs are worth more than my DNA, and I'm informed consent, well, then that's my choice to do. The problem is people are not equipped. They're not aware. They don't understand the downstream effects of how the data can be used for them, against them, you know, all these other kinds of things. And they're not getting a fair bargain. They are getting the equivalent of, three Big Macs for something that is worth a whole lot more than that. And so that's the part that bothers me, is that it's not a fair bargain where both sides are at arm's length, equally equipped to make the decision. In fact, we're asking people to make these decisions who, you know, based upon their age, the frontal lobe hasn't fully developed yet. And yet we're asking them to make eternal decisions because the internet never forgets. So there's an issue.
I'm so glad I did all my stupid things before the internet.
Oh, good.
I was.
I'm still doing mine.
I was just on the cusp of it. So like half my stupid things got put on the internet. Let's move on to our last story for today, industry myths that just won't die. So today, as in the day this episode comes out, marks the beginning of Cybersecurity Awareness Month. And what better way to celebrate than an airing of grievances in true Festivus style? Users on the r/cybersecurity subreddit had an interesting conversation going where they were sharing the industry myths that make them, as security professionals, quote, facepalm every single time they hear it. So to wrap us up for today, I would like to know what myths our panelists would like to see die. And I'm going to start with you, Claire. What myth is grinding your gears?
So when I opened that thread, the first thing I saw was the password one. And that is the most common one that I hear everybody always say, like, I'm so sick of the password rotation. And I mean, as a user, it is very annoying to have to rotate your password. If you have a password manager, far easier. But that's one that, you know, I think users and security folks alike both dislike, especially if you're, which you, no one should be, but one of those people that uses like pet name, three numbers, and symbol, like you run out of variations.
Hey, I put 2 exclamation points on the end of mine. Thank you. That makes that little green bar that says, you know, quality of password, at least green. Moves it to yellow.
Good. Yeah.
By the way, I saw a critter walking around behind you. What's that critter's name? Just curious. Not that I'm trying to steal your password.
she's too new in my life. So she's not in any passwords, but her name is Pita Pocket.
Okay. All right. Oh, good name. Okay. All right. I know what your future passwords will be.
Nick, how about you? What myth would you like to see die?
So when I looked in that Reddit thread, the first one that did get my attention, but isn't my favorite, is the one that said, well, Macs never get viruses, right? So that one used to just grind my gears completely, especially since I wasn't a Mac person. And I've always ended up working with a Mac person. And they always had that cult mentality that their device was impervious to anything. And I was sadly shouldn't have been happy, but happy to see that myth broken. The one that bothers me the most is when I hear, especially when I hear from a security professional, is when they say that they don't have smart devices or, you know, the smart assistants or anything. I don't use any of that. I don't have any of that in my house because I don't want to be listened to. Meanwhile, they're walking around with the latest and greatest mobile device right in their pocket everywhere they go, not realizing that ship has already sailed.
And selling their phone call data.
Yes.
And selling their phone call data while they're posting about their bad date from the night before on T.
Okay, I've learned my lesson. I'll stop selling my phone call data. Jeff, how about you? What myth would you like to see crushed?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. How much time do we have for? So I'm gonna double down on what both have said here, but Claire in particular, the making people change their passwords on a regular interval, that is old security thinking. The U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology came out with new guidelines for passwords, and I say new as in 2017, and they still haven't gotten the word out. Come on, folks, 2017, and they said stop doing that. You know, don't do that anymore. If somebody has a good password, making them change it regularly just makes them make it worse because now they've got to keep up with more. And it makes them more likely to write them down. It makes them more likely to reuse the password across multiple systems. And all of that is sort of it comes from security people thinking without understanding that there's a human at the other end of all of this. They're thinking like mathematicians, okay, like password complexity. So this is the one I'm going to add on to it. The other one, that passwords, the more complex you make a password, the more secure it is. Also not true. Unless you're using a password manager to generate it and store it and manage it all, which most people don't, even though I wish they would. So password complexity, again, if I give you a rule that says you have to do an upper and a lower case and a special character and a number and you can't use it, you know, all these kinds of rules, not only do they narrow the password key space a little bit, but they also only do one thing, and that's they guarantee that people are going to write these things down.
And I would have gotten away with it if it weren't for you meddling kids.
Exactly, they would. Thank you, Shaggy.
After this, I'm going to have to burn my Post-it note containing all of my passwords. That's all the time that we have for today, though, folks. I want to thank you, Claire and Nick and Jeff, for being here. Thank you to our listeners and viewers, especially YouTube user Yuli5869, who complimented my shirt last week. Thank you, Yuli. Make sure to subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. Stay safe out there, and just set up a passkey or something, man. Just be done with the passwords.